Okay, so I think it's time for us to get started. So first of all, thank you for being here. My name is Andre Cruz. I work at Brightpixel, and I'm here to talk to you about Kubernetes and how to set up a Kubernetes cluster on Azure platform. First of all, if you have any questions, you can use this hashtag. I won't promise that I'll be always on top of Twitter during the presentation, but at least at the end or even after the presentation is done, I'll make sure that I answer all any questions that appear on Twitter. This is the agenda that we'll follow on this session. First of all, I will talk a bit about containers and why should we use them. Then Kubernetes, what is Kubernetes, what purpose does it serve? Then I'll do a quick demo of how to set up a Kubernetes cluster and deploy a demo application. And then I'll talk a little bit more about what's next for Kubernetes, specifically for the Azure platform. So, what is Kubernetes? So, according to their homepage, Kubernetes is an open source platform for automating deployment, scaling, and operations of application containers across clusters of hosts, providing a container-centric infrastructure. So it started in 2014 at Google. They say that it builds upon a decade and a half of experience that Google has while running production workloads at scale. I would say that they have been very successful at that. And since it's an open source effort, it combines these ideas from Google with the ideas also from the community itself. Supposedly, it is based on Borg, which is also a scheduler but it's an internal tool that Google has used for, they say, for more than 10 years. And so they have built on that experience. This is not Borg because they say that they can't release it. But it's based on what they think are the best characteristics of the Borg platform. But why use containers, first of all? I know that there already have been some sessions about this, but just a quick introduction for people that didn't attend the previous session. So a container, in this case a Docker container, is a packaging format. And packaging is a lot of times a pain point, right? So you build a great application, and then you want to package in a format that runs the same way for everybody, right? So, but there are module versions, or dependency versions, you use a certain Python version, and sometimes the platform where you want to run your application does not support it. So it's always a pain point for when you reach the production phase. And this Docker packaging format, it's like a contract between the developer and the deployment system that you're going to use. Okay, so the deployment system takes this package. It doesn't care what's inside, what modules they use. It will run it, and it will run the same way in every Docker engine that you try to launch it on. So Kubernetes assumes that your application will be packaged in some kind of container image. Right now it supports Docker images, also Rocket images, but in the future it may support different kinds of images. So why do we need an orchestrator? So in development, you can sometimes launch your containers manually. You have like a Docker Compose file, for example, that you use it to launch your containers in your development machine. And even in some scenarios in production, you may even launch your containers manually. But then you start to think, so what happens? I need something that will replicate my containers, for example, if you want to accommodate a larger load of requests, you need to launch more instances of your application, and you probably want to do it automatically, right? So you need something to do it for you. You need something that automatically restarts your containers if they have a problem, or if the computer where they're running crashes, you need to launch them on another computer. And you need something to load balance the traffic between the containers, right? So These are the main tasks of an orchestrator. And then why Kubernetes? So Kubernetes provides a set of systems that enable you to build a distributed application that's reliable and scalable in the cloud in a manner that's almost simple. It's a hard problem to solve. It's a tool that has a single API, so it provides several services like service discovery, and the naming, etc. And they all sit behind this API. So it has, for example, an etcd service that it uses for secrets management, etc., configuration management. But you don't get to interact with this backend service. Everything is designed through the Kubernetes API. So later on, if they decide to change the underlying service, the application does not need to change anything. It just uses the Kubernetes API. And also, it provides new abstractions to describe what an application deployment looks like. So instead of just saying, oh, well, there's a container, you need to run this container, in Kubernetes you say, here is a pod. So what's a pod? A pod can be one or more application containers. For example, you can have a web app, a pod of a web application that needs an Nginx front-end and some kind of web application server on the back-end, like a micro WSGI, for example. And a pod will encompass these two containers. And the pod will share the same networking stack and the volumes that it mounts with all the containers that it launches. So the pod is the lowest level unit that Kubernetes uses. And so through this, Kubernetes allows you, as I say here in the slide, it allows you to deploy applications quickly and predictably. So since it has a declarative format for all these tasks, you can expect it to behave always in the same way. It's very easy to scale your applications just through configuration. It's just a matter of specifying how many replicas of a container you need to have launched. And this number, of course, can change on the fly. And it can also change automatically, so you can rely on Kubernetes to alter the number of replicas of your application according to the resource usage of your containers. It's also easy to do rolling upgrades, to roll out new features without downtime, which is very important. Nowadays, people tend to do deployments, multiple deployments per day, so there needs to be a simple way to do rolling deployments with no downtime and still have tests running in the background, etc. And it also allows you to optimize the usage of your hardware resources, because it tries to cram as many containers as possible, pods as possible in the same server, all according to the resource usage specifications and limits that you can configure in the pod deployment descriptor. Okay, so specifically about Kubernetes. Where does Kubernetes fit in the architecture of your system? So Kubernetes will lay between your application and the underlying operating system. And this operating system may be running in a VM in some cloud, or you can be in your own data center on bare metal servers. Kubernetes runs on Linux machines. There are several distributions that you can use. Personally, I use CoreOS, which is an operating system designed for container workloads. It has a minimum set of tools pre-installed, and everything else is run through containers, which I think it's a great match with the Kubernetes cluster. So in our architecture, we will have three types of servers. There are the etcd VMs. So etcd is a distributed consistent key value store that you can use for shared configuration and service discovery. It uses the REST protocol for consensus, and this is where the Kubernetes API, in particular, will store its state. I've seen some Kubernetes clusters where the etcd daemon is run alongside the master component, so you just have two types of servers. But in my experience, as your cluster grows, the load of your etcd components will grow as well. So you you'll need to scale this etcd cluster before you have to scale your master component. So master components, it's just the API and some other components that I'll talk about later, but all state is stored in the etcd cluster. So this cluster will see an increased load as the cluster grows in size. And then you have your node VMs, and these node VMs are where your pod applications will be launched. So as you grow in number of pods, the number of node VMs will need to grow as well to accompany the amount of resources that you need to run all your applications. Now, in terms of the components that run on master VMs, there are just three of them. It's the API server itself, which is stateless. As I've said, all state is stored in the etcd cluster. And almost every external utility, like your kubectl binary to manage your cluster, or your nodes that will need to know which pods to launch, they will all these requests will come through the API server. And then there's a controller manager. The controller manager is responsible for taking action based on changes to your replication controllers. And these replication controllers, they are responsible for specifying how many pods to launch of a specific type. And so when you need to launch a new pod because the load in a certain application has increased, it's this component that is responsible for creating this event that a new pod needs to be scheduled. And it will communicate to the API server that a new pod needs to be scheduled. And then comes the scheduler. The scheduler is a component responsible for checking with the API if there are any unscheduled pods. It will find the best node to run them and also notify the API of this fact. So these are all very microservices in terms of the Kubernetes architecture. Now, in terms of the node VMs, there are only two components that need to run there. The first one is the kubelet. So the kubelet is the agent that on each machine will start and stop pods and run all the other machine level tasks. It will talk to the API server periodically, and through this, it will know what pods it needs to run or stop, etc. And also there is a proxy component, which is responsible for receiving the traffic from the that is destined for specific services or pods that run on that machine, and will direct it to the correct port on the container. It will also communicate with the API server to be kept up to date in regards to routes and ports, etc. So I mentioned that these two components run the node VMs, but I also run them on the master components. And why is that? So as I said, the kubelet is a component that is responsible for keeping pods running according to some specification from the API server or through manifest files. And so I think it makes sense to use it to also take care of the master components. And so we also will run a kubelet on the master components, and in this way, master components will also be registered and can also be manipulated through the Kubernetes management interface. We can check logs and see if there is any problem with one of the master components using the Kubernetes tools as well. And we also run a proxy on the master VMs because most of the time, you will want to run a log aggregation system, like, for example, FluentD. And you will want to run them on the master components as well. And running these on the master components means you also need to run a proxy there so that it can access the Kubernetes API and enrich the log stream with Kubernetes-specific information, like which pod name is that message. Which pod emitted that log event, which namespace, which container name. We can go through all these details and add them to the log messages so that we can have a richer logging stream than in our central logging environment. In terms of infrastructure, these are the components that will be launched on Azure. So starting in the bottom, we'll have the three etcd nodes, which are only accessed by the master VMs and the API server. And we will have two master nodes for high availability reasons. As I've said, the load on these nodes will not increase a lot with the growth of the cluster, but for high availability reasons, it's best to have more than one. Right? If all the master components fail, the running applications will continue to be running, but we will not be able to make changes, launch new pods or delete pods. We can do any one of those operations. We'll have a load balancer to balance the traffic between the two master nodes, and this load balancer, the master load balancer, is where the API clients will connect to either the kube control, kubectl binary, or the nodes themselves. So we will also have another load balancer above the nodes, and this is where the clients will connect to reach our applications that are running on the Kubernetes cluster. So going into a bit more detail in terms of Kubernetes, these are the specific components that each entity talks to. So kubectl, which is mainly used for managing the cluster, talks to the API servers and the API server. The kubelet on each node also talks to the API server, and the clients have access to the internet. We use proxies to reach our pods. There's also the concept of a namespace. Normally, we launch applications inside the namespace, and we can have, for example, a different namespace for different environments, like a staging environment, a production environment of the same application. We'll probably run in different namespaces. So this is a way to encapsulate the different pods and services that the same application may have, so that they can find one another in the same namespace, and they are self-contained. We can see here, for example, on the right, we could have a Phoenix application that only needs one container. It has a replication controller and exposes a service. And on the left-hand side, maybe we have a back office which has pods that need an Nginx and an application server container. It also exposes a service, and there's a replication controller that manages the number of pods that need to be running. Okay, there are several similar products to Kubernetes. Some of them have already been, there have been sessions on them. At least I saw one on Docker Swarm recently. And well, there are similar. I just wanted to speak a little bit about each one of them. I won't go into many details, but Marathon is a container orchestration platform for Mesos. And Mesos is built, it's built as a data center operating system. For me, it's an abstraction level above Kubernetes itself. So it has it's a bit too complicated for me. It has too many moving parts. You need a team. Typically, you need a team to manage this type of clusters. And you can run Kubernetes on Mesos clusters can run Kubernetes clusters inside them. So you can see that the abstraction level is a bit different between these two tools. Swarm is a product by Docker. It's a Docker clustering solution. It turns a pool of Docker hosts into a single Docker host, a virtual Docker host. And it exposes the standard Docker API. It's very easy to set up. Yeah. And I feel that it's still a bit in its infancy. It does not have as many features as Kubernetes, but it has been evolving quite rapidly. So we'll see where it goes. There is also Rancher. It's another platform for deploying and managing containers. Again, we can also run Kubernetes inside Rancher, so I feel that it's a bit, it's an abstraction level different than Kubernetes. It has a nice graphical user interface and it can integrate with several enterprise access control solutions. So it has a niche market for it. And there's also Nomad. Nomad is a project, it's a relatively new project compared with all the others. It's also an orchestrator. It's a bit simpler than Kubernetes to set up, but it relies on other projects of the HashiCorp ecosystem. So it has Consul for service discovery, Vault for secret management, and compared to Kubernetes, Kubernetes abstracts all these services on the same API. So it's a little bit different than Nomad. But we can, of course, rely on the very scientific method of comparing GitHub stars of all these projects, since they are all open source projects that are hosted on GitHub. And you can see that there's clearly a winner here in terms of GitHub stars. So we'll go now to the demo. I have a GitHub repository with a script to deploy a Kubernetes cluster on Azure. For this, I use the two tools that I'm used to working with. It's Terraform and Ansible. I could have used just AAM ARM templates, but it's just a personal reason. I'm used to these tools. They work. They're not specific to any platform. So that's the reason why I use them. But I know there's an AARM template that it's being worked on for setting up a Kubernetes infrastructure, much like the one I'm going to describe here. There's a pull request open for integrating this ARM template in the Azure Quick Start template repository. I may supply a link to it on the show notes. So, let's start with the setting up the infrastructure. To set up, use Terraform, we use a file to describe the infrastructure. So it's a file like this. You can have variables, then you set up your provider, then you start to set up your resource group, virtual networks, routing tables, subnets. Then you go on to storage accounts, etc. Then your virtual machines. As I said, I use the CarOS. And to be honest, I cheated in the sense that I already ran this script before the session. And this is, and why did I do that? Because it can take a few minutes to run this, depending, it always takes a few minutes, but sometimes the Azure API can take a bit longer to set up, for example, the storage account. To make sure that we are not looking here at the script running, I run it beforehand. So if I run it again now, since Terraform is a declarative format, Terraform will check to see what's already deployed, compare it with what I want my infrastructure to be, and apply any differences. What will happen here is that since I've already run the script, it will conclude that there's nothing to do. Everything is already deployed. So we'll just let it finish here. Okay, so as I've said, it has determined that nothing needs to be added, changed, or destroyed to make it compliant with what I've specified. So what we need to do next, well, I've also mentioned here the version of the tool that I'm using, so you won't have any problems with that. So the next thing we need to do is, this is specific to CarOS. So Ansible requires client machines that it connects to have a Python interpreter to run its model. And CarOS does not ship with a Python interpreter because it tries to have the minimum pre-installed tools to be usable. So Python is not needed. So what this script will do, it will install a Python interpreter on the home of our user, so that we can use it on the next tasks. So in this case, we use an Azure dynamic inventory model for Ansible. It fetched all the machines from the Azure API. These errors are not really errors. This is just a check to see that we haven't already run this script. So it has determined that they haven't been bootstrapped yet. So it's running our script. Meanwhile, I can check the Azure portal to see what behavior in our Kubernetes Labs cluster that I've set up. So it's here. So you can see that we have the availability sets for all three types of servers that I mentioned, three etcd nodes, a jump box to connect to all the nodes that are behind that are in our virtual network, so we need this jump box to connect to them. We have our master VMs, our node VMs, our master load balancer, and then we have the needs of each machine, the security groups, the public IPs, etc. So our script is still running. It will install, besides Python, it will install also the pip, which is a tool to install Python modules. And we're almost done. So after this, we will need to create our PKI infrastructure. Our communications between the nodes and the master API, and even between our kube control binary and the master API, they're all encrypted, and there's a PKI infrastructure to ensure authentication, etc. So we will need to generate these certificates. So our script is finished. We have Python on our machines, because now we can use Ansible modules. But first of all, we will create our certificates. Okay, I'll just use here the cached inventory so that you speed up the process. So it will generate a CA to sign all the other certificates. It will generate one certificate for the API server that will be shared amongst all master VMs. And then it will generate worker certificates, one for each node. Each node will have a different certificate. All these certificates are signed by our CA that we also created. So we have here our CA certificate and all the other certificates that I mentioned. Okay. Now we can install Kubernetes itself. That's good. And I can talk about what we're doing here while the script is running. So this script is running Kubernetes setup recipe. So it will first initialize our etcd nodes. Etcd comes with CoreOS, so because it's a service that they use for other tasks as well, to coordinate updates and things like that. So it's already installed, we just need to start it. There's a template to configure it, and we have that template over here. It just mentions on which addresses it should listen, and on which interface it should advertise itself. The next thing to do is install the master nodes. So we'll, of course, create the directory for storing certificates, copy them, we'll start Docker, and we'll create a systemd unit for Kubelet. Kubelet and Docker are the components that are managed by systemd. All the other components are of the Kubernetes master service are managed by the kubelet itself. So what we do here is, since the master kubelet does not have an API to connect to when it starts, we have files that tell it to what pods to launch. And these manifest files are stored in this directory. And Kubelet, when it starts, it will look at all the files in this directory and will make sure that all the pods that need to be running are running and are kept running in case of a crash. Then we'll reload systemd daemons and we'll start kubelet itself. And we'll wait for everything to start up. So that's what we're doing right now. We're waiting for the API to spin up. I can go into one of these machines and see what they're up to. Okay. As soon as it lets me in. We're still waiting. So what's kubelet doing now is downloading the Docker images of all the components of the API server, controller manager, scheduling, etc. So that's why it's taking a bit to... Okay, so I didn't add my key. Okay, here we are. Okay, so it's already started, and you see on this, particularly on this machine that I was, the API has already, it already started. So then we moved on to the nodes, to the node VMs. Here we just need to also copy the certificates and configure kubelet and the kubeproxy. And that's what we're doing right now. So here, I can show you what Docker is running. We have the proxy component that I mentioned. We also have the controller manager. We have the scheduler and the API server and the kubelet. And these pod components are, so each pod has a pod container running inside it, and this container is the component that stores the networking stack and the mounted volumes, etc. So if you have a pod that has several containers running and one of the containers crashes, you can just restart the container because it's this pod container that has all the networking stack and the volumes that the pod needs. So these are not lost when a container crashes. Okay, so we have started our Kubernetes cluster. I just need to tell my kubectl to use this cluster. This is all explained in the GitHub repository. I have this in my history file. So if I fetch the nodes that are currently on the cluster, we can see that we have both the two master VMs. They are ready. And they are scheduled disabled. What this means is that we don't let the scheduler start pods on our master VMs, our application pods. These are only started on node VMs. So you'll see that when these node VMs appear, they won't have that flag. So these are the Kubernetes events as they're coming in. You see that we already have events pertaining to the nodes. Events like has disk, has memory, sufficient memory to start. So if we check the nodes now, we can see that they're already registered, but are still in a not ready state. They are still starting up. So if I can go into one of the nodes, see what's happening here. So it's starting up. Still starting some containers. And has begun starting the kubeproxies. And I think we're almost done here. Let's see. So yeah, all the nodes are ready. So and if you check the pods that are running on our cluster, you can see that we have two API servers, one for each master node, two controller managers, and we have four proxies because we have one on each node, on each master node, and the master VM and node VM, and we have the scheduler master, which also runs on the master node. So This is a bare bones cluster, Kubernetes cluster. Now, what we need to do is install the DNS add-on. This add-on is a, well, almost all clusters use this add-on for discovery purposes. This is how you can, for example, if you have a namespace that has a web server and a database, you can use DNS to find the address of the database that you need to connect to. That's specific to your namespace. So there are two things that we need to create here. The first one is a service. And you can see that if we query the API for services, in the default namespace, we have only the Kubernetes service. This is the API server. But if we query all namespaces, we can see that in the kubesystem namespace, we have the Kubernetes DNS service already configured. And this will run on this cluster IP. So every pod can resolve names by querying a namespace server, a name, name server that will answer on this IP. And now we need to launch the pods that will service this DNS system. So because for now we only have the service, which is like a load balancer, but we don't have any pods that fulfill this service. So if we try to connect to this IP, there's no one to answer us this time. So what we need to do is create this deployment. And we can see here that two pods have been launched. There are two because for load balancing reasons. So you could have just one or you can have more than two. And this pod is comprised of three different containers. And right now, so two of them have already been fetched and launched. There's only one still missing. We can fetch the events to see what's happening. Okay, we created the component. And if we check again, okay, everything is running as it should be. So now we have a cluster, a Kubernetes cluster deployed, and we also have naming discovery based on DNS. So now we can launch some applications. The first thing, well, there's also another add-on that I think is useful, which is the dashboard. So it's like a web UI that we can use to, well, it's an easier way to make sense of what's happening in our cluster. And to do that, I'm going to launch I think this is a bit too small, right? I need to increase the font size. What I'm going to do is go here to my Kubernetes repository into the cluster head-ons. And there are several head-ons here that you can use. The one I want is a dashboard. So again, let's create this service first. So if we query our services now, we have a new service, so the Kubernetes dashboard, and then we will deploy our controller. So if we check our pods now, you see there's a new one being created, which is our dashboard. In order to access this dashboard, the easiest way is to use the kubectl and set up a proxy. What this will do, it will set up a tunnel, an authenticated tunnel, because kubectl has a token that it can use to query the API. And so so that you don't have to set up your authentication in the browser itself. Kubectl will set up a tunnel that will be listening on this port, and it's already authenticated, so you can use it to query the API, etc. In this case, we want to reach our dashboard, which appears to be already up. Yes, it's already running. So this is a web UI for our Kubernetes cluster. We cannot create stuff. And we can check what namespaces we have. We just have two of them. And the nodes, of course, there's four of them. Any volumes? We don't have anyone. We don't have any volumes right now. So in our default namespace, there are no pods. Of course, if I go to the Kube system namespace, there are already pods running that they are part of the control plane of our Kubernetes cluster. So in order to deploy our example app, I'm going to create a new namespace for it. So let's call it Heypol, because that's the name of our demo app. So we have a new namespace. We refresh here, we refresh our page over here. We will see that we have a new namespace, but there's nothing there yet. So let's change it. The first thing that we need to do, since this is a web application that I'm going to deploy, it exposes a service, right? The service that listens on the port 80 and to which browsers will connect. So the first thing that I need to do is create this Heypol service on the namespace Heypol. So, and what's this file over here? Open. So this is a simple description of a service that our application will expose. We have here some metadata. We have the type of service. Since this is a load balancer type, what this will do, it will create an Azure load balancer, and will create a public IP address, and will create all the necessary rules for when a request comes in for that public IP address on port 80. It will instead be directed to our containers that are selected through this query. So our containers will have these labels, the app label and the tier label, and so all the traffic that comes to the public IP address on that port will be redirected to those containers on port 8080. So while Kubernetes is setting up the load balancer, we can query our services again. You can see there's a new service here. Whose external IP is still pending because it's setting up the load balancer, etc. We can look here in the Azure portal, and we can see that already we have a new load balancer that was created for this cluster the first time it was needed. And as we have more applications, it will reuse the same load balancer. What it will have is more rules. So this is a rule that was created specifically for this service. So all traffic that comes on port 80 will be redirected to the Kubernetes cluster port 32,370. This is a random port that it doesn't tell us very much. It's just the port that our nodes will be listening to serve this application. And all the nodes are able to service this. If there's not a container of our application on one of the nodes, the proxy component will take care of redirecting the traffic to a node that has this container running. Okay, so let's check again. Still pending, but okay, we can continue and I'll check this later on. Right now, we're going to launch a database because our web application will need one. And so I will launch here our database, which is a Postgres database. You can check here the pods that are being launched. So we can see here that there's a new pod being created, which is a Postgres pod, which will be our database. We also have another service created. I'm querying services of all namespaces, that's why you see them all mixed up, but normally each application will be restricted to its namespace. So we have here already the database service created and the APL, which is a public facing service. And so let's check to see. So it's still, our database is still being created. I can show you exactly what I launched. So as you can see here, we can specify both the service and the deployment on the same file, as long as it's separated by this delimiter. So we have a database service. This time it's not a load balance service. It's just a little service that will listen on a cluster IP on this port, and we'll redirect our traffic to a container that satisfies these three labels on that port. So it's the same port, it's a well-known port of Postgres. And here we have a deployment that will launch containers that match. You can see here that these labels match the labels that the service is expecting. So when it tries to find the container to service request, this selector will match with these containers. In this case, it's just one container. So it's a Postgres image we're using. And here we have an Azure volume. So this is a volume that I've created previously. It's stored here on this storage account. We just give it a name here. And then on the container specification, we mount this volume on this path. And this is the path where Postgres will store its data file. So for example, if this container crashes and you need to launch it either on the same node or on a different node, it will first mount this Azure volume where all the state is stored, so you don't lose if the container crashes in a non-safe way, you may need to replay some of the transactions in the log file, but at least you won't lose all of the database state. Right? So let's see if we have any progress. Still creating the Postgres container. And let's check the service. Okay, so we can see that we already have an external IP for our APL service. Of course, if we try to connect it at this time, there's nothing there yet, so no one will answer our request. If we check here our dashboard, we can see that okay, we already have a Postgres pod running. Okay, so it's ready. It started. We can look at the logs of this pod. Okay, so it started. It launched a Bootstrap script, and now it's ready to accept connection. Okay, so at this time, we are able to launch our web application itself. What we need to do, and I'll show you the deployment script of our application. So it's a deployment, of course. Here, we mentioned that we want two replicas of this pod to be running at the same time. And the image is this one. We specify here the resources that our pod will need, and this is important for Kubernetes to know if a node is over-provisioned or not, if it can launch a pod in that node or more nodes need to be launched, etc. Here we can specify different environment variables. So this is how configuration parameters are passed to the application. The application only needs to read the values from these environment variables, and this is it's language agnostic or almost operating system agnostic. This works everywhere. And we have here a secret. So we have here a value that we don't want to store it on the descriptor, because most of the time these descriptor files are stored alongside the application code in the GitHub repository or any kind of repository. So you don't want to hard code secrets and send them to your VCS system, right? So Kubernetes as a secrets management solution, you just here have to mention the name of the secret and the name of the key, and the value of this key will be exposed also as an environment variable to the application. So in order to launch this application, I'm going to need to create this secret first. So I think I have here command to do it, so create a generic secret. I just need to specify the namespace. Okay, so we created the secret, and at this time we can create the deployment. Okay, so if we check the pods that are running, we can see that it's trying to launch two pods of our application, and it's now starting to download the images. One of the problems with this demo application is that I have everything inside this Docker images for new tests. And this is a problem because you can see here the size of this image, 400 megabytes. It's too big for practical purposes. You should strive to have images that are 100 megabytes or less. Because you have a scale-up or scale-up events, you need to launch more containers of application. And this needs to be fast. So if you need to launch 10 more containers of your application or pods, and these are 400 megabyte images, you see that you need to download 4 gigabytes of data in order to launch 10 more containers, and that quickly adds up in terms of time, startup time, and it makes the whole experience much worse. So you see, we're still waiting for it to start up, and that's mainly because of the size of the image that is being downloaded. So we can describe one of these pods to see where it's being launched. Oh, sorry. We need to specify one of the namespaces. So you can see here that we have the namespace, when it started, the labels that this pod has, it's pending because it's trying to start but it's not started yet. This is the container detail, so this is the command line, and then the resource limits, the state, the start count, etc. I also have a liveness and readiness tests. So these are two tests that are used in different time periods. So when a container starts, this readiness test is used. So in this case, it will try to do a get, an HTTP get to this port, and it will expect to be served with a 200 OK response. And this readiness probe is used to know for the Kubernetes cluster or for the proxy itself to know when it can start sending requests to this container, to be sure that it has been launched, but has it started yet? Is the service already expecting connections? So this is the test that is used. And then there's a liveness test, which is used after the container is ready, so it has passed the readiness test. So in this liveness test is done periodically to know if the container is still in a healthy state and can still serve requests or needs to be restarted. Okay. Other stuff that you can find here, the environment variables are specified. Of course, there are secret variables that which the value we can see here. And this pod has two containers, so it's my application container and the kubeproxy container. This is used to access the API, and so we also launch the kubeproxy container on the same pod. And you can see here a list of events. So the only events we have until now is that it has assigned this pod to this node, and it's downloading the image from Docker Hub. If you check again, okay. It has successfully pulled the image and it has created the container. So if we check the running pods, we see, okay, one of them has already started, and the other one, okay, the other one has one of the containers has started. Okay, so now we have all the containers started. And if you go back to our browser, if we try, I don't know, it's already there, okay. You see, our application is running and it's already listening on this public IP address. However, if we try to access something that needs the database is not there yet. It's not created yet because we started a new database server. So what we need to do, in this case, well, this is specific to Phoenix, but what I wanted to show you is that you can, as if you're using a Docker container in your own laptop, we can go inside one of these pods and execute commands inside the pod. So we want to execute the shell and from the namespace people. Okay, so here we are. I can also show you the environment variables that I said that would be here. So we have stuff specific to Kubernetes, ports, services, database, and these are the ones that are specified. This was the secret one that I mentioned. So as you can see here, the application only needs to access the environment variable to fetch all the needed configuration parameters. What I wanted to do here is to create a database. So it's contacting the database server. And request has been created and now migrated. Oh, sorry, restart. So you now have all the tables and all the relations that we need. You refresh here, see, okay. Application is started, we can create a new poll and delete the poll. We have a database running. Another thing that I wanted to show you was how the database is discovered. So you see here the host name of the database. And this is because on this pod you can resolve the database name. Database name, it resolves to this IP address, which is a cluster IP. It's a service IP, and this is because if you remember here, when you created the database service, we named it database. So we can resolve this na DNS name to reach the cluster IP and so get to the database. I can also show you here on the database part, I can go inside here the part, and I can show you what's mounted here. So this terabyte volume is mounted here, that's it. And this is the Azure volume. And this is where Postgres started its state. Okay, so now we have an application running, and we have two pods running of our application. So let's say we needed the load increase in our application, and we need to launch more containers of our application. That's easy. What we need to do is just run a scale command. So we just tell Kubernetes that the new number of replicas for this deployment, April, it's 5. So if you remember here on our original deployment, we specified 2. So here, if you specify 5, you can see that, okay, 3 new ones have been launched. We don't really care on which node, but we know that on the cluster, we have now 5 instances of our application that are ready to serve our requests. Okay, now all 5 of them are ready. So how can I show you that this load balancer indeed works? I have a new version of this demo app that will print the pod, what the pod considers is the host name, which is the pod name. And so what I would need to do here is as I've altered the number of replicas, I will also need to change the image, or at least the tag of the container image that is being used here. So I just need to do set image. So what I'm doing here is I'm going to this deployment again and setting the image of this container to this one, which is an image that I've built that will print the machine, the name of the machine, not the machine, but the pod. You see that traffic will be balanced somewhat between the pods. It's not really random or round robin, it's based on the, because we have an Azure load balancer before it reaches our Kubernetes cluster, so it will not be completely random, but we will be able to see that traffic is indeed balanced. So we can see here that new containers are starting to be launched on a new deployment, on a new image, but we still have containers that are running the previous version. So this is to have a rolling update without downtime, and the number of containers that need to be running all the time is also configurable. What it's doing here, terminated one of the pods of the old version and started 2 of the new version. As I mentioned, this implies downloading 800 megabytes of data, so this may take a minute or so. And when these pods are started, we will see that the old pods will begin to be downscaled. And so after a while, we will have only pods that are running the new image and no pods left that are running the old image. So we just need to wait a little bit for the not download of the image to finish. And what we'll see next is we printed around here the name of the pod. And what I expect will happen is if I refresh several times, this name will change, and this will signal that we're using a different pod. So it's still downloading. Maybe I can show you how the dashboard looks like now. So we have more stuff here on our Apple namespace. We have the new pods that are being launched with the new image, right? So the image here has changed. And we still have the old pods, and we have the database. All of these are running on the on different cluster IPs, and the services. And we have these services right on. This is the name that the database resolves to. This is the IP that the database DNS entry resolves to. So this is taking longer than I expected. We should really try to have small image sizes so that this process is faster. And I think we're almost there. I can go into one of the machines. This is one of the worker nodes. I should also mention that in for this deployment, I used A1 and the A0 machines, VM sizes, which are not that fast. So the performance would be a lot different if I used a machine with a larger machine. Okay, so let's check. What's happening here? So it's still downloading the image. Didn't find the container, so let's go fetch it. Okay, so we see that some containers have already been fetched. So if we check the pods now, okay, we see that we already have one of the new ones that is still waiting for the readiness check to pass. If you remember, it has been launched, but is not accepting connections yet. It is launching the server. And you already have one running, right? And we can see that already the old ones are being terminated in favor of the new images. So right now, if we the requests that are coming in would be balanced between a bit between a old pods and new pods, but not for a very long time because we already only have one pod that is running the old version of the application. So if I refresh now, okay, you see that we hit this machine, and if I hit restart, you can see that it's being balanced, right? Okay, so in terms of demo, this is what I wanted to show you. I'll get back to my presentation. And what's left is what's next in terms of Kubernetes on Azure. So from what I can see in the development of the platform, I've been following some GitHub. One feature that is already merged in the master branch of the Kubernetes repository, which is dynamic disk provisioning. So, if you remember, I created the when I launched the database, I Kubernetes didn't have any support for provisioning these disks, so it needed to be done inside Kubernetes. But we already have support on the current development version of Kubernetes to create these disks on the fly dynamically and mount them. So this will be present on the next version of Azure 1.5. I don't think this will be backported to 1.4, but 1.5 is supposed to be released before the end of the year, so it won't be too long. Another thing that needs to be addressed is the performance of attaching and detaching Azure disks. So it can take a few minutes to do this. there's the Azure time to mount and mount these volumes to the API, but there's also some things that can be improved on the Kubernetes side, and these are also improvements that have not been merged yet, but are on track to be merged. And especially if your pod crashes that has a mounted volume, and the pod is launched on a different node, so detaching this from another node and mounting on the new node can take a few minutes, and that's a bad experience. That's something that needs to be improved. Another thing that is not yet, there's no ETA on it yet, but it's being developed. It's the Azure Cluster Autoscale. So Kubernetes will take care, if you configure it to, it will take care to launch more pods of your application if it notices that it needs more resources. But it needs to have nodes with the resources available. It won't launch new nodes to launch pods. And this is because there's no support yet for the Azure platform, for the autoscaling, the cluster autoscale tool. When this is deployed, when this is merged, the support is merged, then Kubernetes will not only take care of launching more pods, but it launching and removing pods if you don't need them. It will also launch new nodes and decommission nodes as long as your resource usage varies, and this will improve your resource usage. There is also a development, there's no development yet, but there's an idea that an Azure Ingress controller would be nice to have. So an Ingress controller is a layer 7 load balancer that will balance the traffic between Kubernetes services. So you don't use the platform native load balancer, you balance inside the Kubernetes cluster. And there's already an implementation based on Nginx that runs on the cluster itself. There's also another implementation based on the Google platform services, based on routes. And in the future, there will be another implementation that will be based on the Azure Application Gateway. We feel that this is a good fit for this feature. But there's no ETA on this yet. So, this is all that I wanted to share with you. Again, if I find any questions on Twitter, I will answer them after this session. Thank you for being here. Thank you for listening. And as I said before, if you have any questions, just use the hashtag that I provided earlier. And this presentation will be available shortly on the webpage, the recorded presentation. So thank you.